You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I am Jeff Hayden. For those of you who are expecting to hear about immigration issues, that show has been postponed but because my guest needed to reschedule, but frankly, the recent events this week warrant an immediate discussion. Our topic tonight will be the presidential nomination of Dean Kavanaugh to be an Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court. My guest and I will be talking about how somebody gets to be nominated, the process by which he or she gets confirmed. If Judge Kavanaugh does become Justice Kavanaugh, what does this mean to us? Just what does the Supreme Court do? If you have questions for my guest, our phone number to us here in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or if you're outside of the local dialing area, you can call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. In the studio with me tonight is someone I find to be somewhat of a legend in this business. I've said that before, with whom it's a real privilege to share this microphone, and that's Dean Johnson. Let me welcome you to Your Legal Rights.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for that great introduction.
We were talking about a month ago, it seems, about the president, whether he can pardon himself, just how the impeachment process works, if it is going to work. And here we are, such a short time later, talking about somebody who may sit on the court that decides some of those issues. So, welcome back.
Thank you. It's a privilege.
I want to start by inviting anyone who has an interest in our system of laws, the checks and balances that, until recently, accompanied presidential nominations, and this should be all of us, and any of you to call in. And again, our phone numbers to us here in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. And with that, Dean, let me welcome you. Welcome back to Your Legal Rights.
Thanks, Jeff.
I'd like to start with this. Before we start talking about the nomination or about individuals, just what is the role of the Supreme Court?
Well, the Supreme Court is a separate and independent branch of government. It's the highest court in the land. It's sometimes called the least dangerous branch of government, but because it's passive. It has to sit and wait for a case to decide before it can do anything. But its power really cannot be overestimated because, as we've seen historically, the Supreme Court, with the stroke of a pen, can create a cultural revolution, can free a whole group of people. And we've seen that recently in the gay marriage decision. We've seen it in the past in things like school desegregation. And, of course, in Roe versus Wade, we saw that the Supreme Court, with the stroke of its pen, freed women to control their own reproductive life. And in Griswold, Connecticut, versus Connecticut, freed married couples to control how they structure their own families. So the Supreme Court is enormously important, though often misunderstood. It tells us what our constitutional rights are and what our Constitution means to us.
And with that, what does an associate justice do?
Well, there are nine justices on the Supreme Court. There's the Chief Justice, whose proper title is Chief Justice of the United States. The associate justices are the other eight justices. Everybody has one vote when it comes to an opinion. The only real distinction is that the most junior associate justice, when they're deciding their opinions in the boardroom, sits in the seat closest to the door and is tasked with the job of sending out and receiving messages from the bailiff who guards the door.
And, of course, we've all seen the movie scenes where somebody tells the justice on her first day on the court or his first day on the court, you know, would you go close the door? No, not that way.
Yeah.
Let's talk a bit about the nomination process.
Sure.
How does somebody typically come to the attention of the president?
Well, typically, the president's staff, when they see a nomination coming up, will start looking at qualified people. You don't have to be a lawyer to be on the Supreme Court, but that is sort of the minimum bar. And if you pass that bar, then the next criterion is what are your achievements in the legal profession? Most justices are former judges from federal courts, but they have been in the past drawn from the ranks of academia, from government, from private practice even. So what the staff looks for is people who are outstanding in their understanding, their interpretation of their law, of the law, and their achievement in the legal profession.
Okay, so let's talk brass tacks. The president has nominated someone. What checks and balances accompany a presidential nomination, and what's changed? Should we be concerned?
Well, the primary check and balance here is in Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, which says that the president may nominate and then, with the advice and consent of the Senate, may appoint a justice to the Supreme Court. And it's that advice and consent part where things get very tangled, because once the nominee is brought forth, there begins a process with the United States Senate. And a justice can be confirmed by a simple majority of the Senate, which would seem to be a fairly easy thing. But where it gets complicated is in the debate, in the battle over the nomination. And it used to be that because the Senate had a rule called the filibuster rule that allowed for unlimited debate, even the minority party could simply stall a nomination that they didn't like by debating forever until somebody says uncle and they withdraw the nomination and somebody more satisfactory to the minority party comes up.
And we've all seen that in movies and the like, filibuster, where somebody gets up there and starts reading out of the phone book or talking stories from their old hometown.
Yeah, the great Jimmy Dean classic, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
But has that changed?
And that has certainly changed. There's a thing called the nuclear option. Filibuster is only a product of Senate rules. And if the Senate makes the rules, it can change the rules. And the so-called nuclear option consists of taking away unlimited debate, allowing debate to be ended, what the Senate calls cloture, by a simple majority vote rather than a three-fifths vote, which means if you've got a 51-49 margin in the Senate.
As we do right now,
you can stop debate and demand a vote and get your nominee through if you can hold your coalition together.
So basically what we're saying, if I understand you right, is unless we have a 50-50 Senate, one side or the other makes the other irrelevant.
Pretty much. If you have a majority now, with the nuclear option in place, which it was for the last nomination for Justice Gorsuch, can essentially push your nominee through if you're the majority party and you approve that nomination.
So as with many other issues, if you live on the coast, you probably live amongst people who see things different than the people who live in the rest of the country. And right now they have one vote more than they need in the Senate.
Yeah, that's true. And it really affects the substantive process, because when you need at least some votes from the minority party in order to get your nomination through and get your justice seated, that's traditionally led to a sort of a compromise and bargaining process over the nominations. And we've gotten justices who tended to be less ideological and less on the extremes. We've even had nominations stopped in the past and nominees withdrawn. But now that seems almost no longer necessary.
So the Senate votes. Presumably he's in.
Yeah, I don't see, given the structure of the Senate now, given the predictions for the upcoming senatorial elections in the midterm, I don't see any rational scenario under which Judge Kavanaugh is not confirmed as the next justice for the Supreme Court.
So we've talked about the nomination process. We've talked a bit about the process by which he's overwhelmingly likely to be confirmed. So let's talk about the court. Let's talk about what that means to the rest of us. And before I start in that portion of the program, I'd again like to invite anyone interested to call. This is the Supreme Court. It's not going to affect us with rulings they make every day, but their rulings are going to affect us. If you're interested in whether it's environmental laws or Roe versus Wade or the Bill of Rights, whether you are protected from excessive police power, whatever it may be. You may have an interest in this discussion. Feel free to call us here in the studio. The number here is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. So, talk a little bit about who this is. Who is Brett Kavanaugh?
Brett Kavanaugh is an interesting character. He's had an outstanding judicial career. For the last 12 years, he's sat on the District of Columbia Court of Appeals, which is sometimes called the Little Supreme Court. Because of the nature of federal jurisdiction, a lot of very important cases will wind up in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeal. He's also had a rather fascinating political career. He was an assistant special prosecutor to Ken Starr, who was in charge of the investigation and prosecution of President Bill Clinton. He was the author of what's come to be known as the Starr Report, which recommended that Bill Clinton be impeached.
When you say the Starr Report, did you mean that Judge Starr was the author of the report, or do you mean Judge Kavanaugh was the author?
Ken Starr was the special prosecutor. Judge Kavanaugh was the principal author of the report that Ken Starr issued when his term as special prosecutor was ended. And that report ultimately led to the impeachment of Bill Clinton. Interestingly enough, Judge Kavanaugh then became a member of the White House staff under George W. Bush. And according to Judge Kavanaugh, he was so impressed with the demands that were placed on the president that he concluded that it was simply inappropriate to indict, investigate, or even impeach a sitting president, because that would be such a distraction from the duties of the presidency that it would cripple the federal government. He wrote a Minnesota Law Review article to that effect, and many people who've been watching this nomination and selection process suggest that that Minnesota Law Review article was the wow factor for the Trump administration in selecting Judge Kavanaugh to be the new nominee, because you put somebody who believes in an extremely broad interpretation of presidential power and believes that presidents should even be immune from lawsuits when they sit on the court. That's just a little bit of insurance for the Trump administration in case the issues coming out of the Mueller special prosecution ever get before the court.
So we're just past the elections. By now, Robert Mueller, who we've discussed at our last meeting, is of a mind to suggest impeachment or perhaps prosecution of the president. And this judge who wrote that article is now a justice on the Supreme Court. And will he have a vote in whether there's power to proceed against the president, whether the president should be immune?
That's another issue of dispute. Some people have suggested that perhaps if that kind of case came before the Supreme Court, the equivalent of Nixon versus the United States, only Trump versus the United States, where the ability of prosecutors to, say, get discovery from the president, to subpoena the president's records, if that ever came before the court, perhaps Justice Kavanaugh, or the person who would be by then Justice Kavanaugh, should remove himself from that decision, because he had already expressed his opinion so strongly on the issues that would come before the court. It seems to me like that probably is not a grounds for recusal, and I doubt that the Justice Kavanaugh would see it as necessary to recuse himself.
And of course, when we're talking the Supreme Court, there's nobody telling them what they have to do. They are the authority of what they have to do.
Exactly. There's no appeal from the Supreme Court except, as they say, to the Law Review.
Jeff from Berkeley. This is Jeff from Your Legal Rights. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. I'll try to do this as articulately as possible. There's a couple of moving parts to it, but it has to do with Roe versus Wade. The position of Kavanaugh is really pretty clear that he's against Roe versus Wade, no matter what he may say when he's questioned, because of the decision in Texas involving a 16-year-old minor that was being held by ICE. and she wanted an abortion, and he personally went out way out of his way to block it, and that's documented. So here's the question. It's razor thin, 49 to 51. God knows how many votes of the 49 Democrats are going to, you know, come forth. It'll be almost all of them, I think, except Manchin and the lady in North Dakota and somebody else in Indiana or someplace like that. And the reality is 70%, here's the question coming, 70% of the country is in favor of Roe versus Wade. So there's a lot of people in red states and flyover country that really want Roe versus Wade, and there are a lot of senators that could vote against Kavanaugh, and I really think he should be voted against. He's clearly prejudiced. He's not been honest about it at all. He's against Roe versus Wade, but there's a number of senators that can be pressured, and the only way you can pressure them is to for constituents to call in and say, vote him down, and here's the reasons why. How do you mount a campaign like that? That's the question. I want Dean's analysis of what I just said. He can put it more cogently than I did, but I think I've laid the gist of it out.
Jeff, let me see if I can sum this up for you. Given that a majority, an overwhelming majority of Americans, something north of 70%, believe that Roe versus Wade should remain the law of the land, and you have a judge who has stated an opposition to Roe versus Wade.
He's on record.
And has gone on record as such.
Yes.
How do we go about
Texas?
How can people such as Jeff, who are interested in doing so, go about mounting a campaign to make sure that Judge Kavanaugh does not become Justice Kavanaugh? How do we go about educating the senators so that they would vote?
Publicizing it to their constituents.
And we want to reach out not only to the individual members of the Senate, but to the constituencies who vote for them and educate individuals about this judge so that the voters have their words heard by their senators.
Well, I wish I could be more optimistic about this, but as I said, I don't believe there's any realistic political scenario where Judge Kavanaugh is not confirmed. If you want to give it a chance, the place to focus would be on the toss-up elections in the Senate. Right now, there are three senators, Donnelly of Indiana, Manchin of West Virginia, and Heitkamp of North Dakota, who are facing toss-up elections. They're Democrats in red states. And if they're going to behave rationally, they're going to be moving from what's perceived by their voters as the left side of the spectrum towards the right side of the spectrum. And the best way to do that is to defect and vote with Republicans on the confirmation of Justice Kavanaugh. If there's any place where this can be halted, it would be by doing what you can, contributing what you can, educating anybody you can to shape those races and to shape those judges to convince them that that's not a smart move. But as I say, it's a huge uphill battle. We talk about the possibility of stalling the confirmation until the Senate election, until the senatorial elections come up with the hope that the Senate will flip and become Democratic. But that's not going to happen unless these three senators make a shift to the right and convince their predominantly conservative voters that they are the appropriate candidate to reelect. So there's sort of a paradox here. The only way to get to a point of flipping the Senate to a Democratic Senate would be for these three senators to actually move to the right and support Judge Kavanaugh. And if you can find a way out of that, if you can find some way to pitch this so that these senators become convinced and their constituents become convinced that that's not the proper road to go, that's the only way out.
The only way to target it that seems like me, but, you know, this is beyond my experience, would be to go after Republican senators in districts where there is the 70% that's very clear. I don't know where that would be, but, you know, there's statistics and that you can match demographics. and go after the Republican senators and say, I know you're supposed to vote this way, that's what you're being told to do by the majority, Mitch McConnell, your whip in the Senate, but that's not what your constituents want. Your constituents want Roe versus Wade, so break ranks. And if you don't break ranks, we'll stick a senator, another Democrat or a Republican in your, against you the next election. I don't know. That seems to me the only weak point. There must be a half a dozen or so Republican senators out there that are in districts that are not all that strong in favor of against Roe versus Wade.
Well,
that's
Jeff,
that's the point I'm making.
Jeff, thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights. And I guess what you've just done is illustrated the paradox that Dean was just talking about. And that is, we can do that. We can come forth and convince Democratic senators to put their seats up to block this one nomination, knowing that they probably won't succeed in keeping Judge Kavanaugh off the court, but they may well succeed in keeping a Democratic majority from taking the Senate. On the other hand, we could convince Republican senators, particularly moderates, that a majority of Americans, perhaps a majority of their constituents, want Roe versus Wade to remain the law of the land. And if they were the ones that act as proxies and vote against it, so that the Democrats could stay, then they could lose their majority. I see some political problems there, but I will leave that to Dean if I'm missing something.
The math is just not there. In order to flip the Senate, the Democrats have to win all of the elections that they're supposed to win, all of the elections that are leaning Democratic, as well as the majority of the elections that are considered toss-ups. Republicans have only a few seats at risk. They are not looking at, with two exceptions, they're not looking at real toss-up elections, and the Republicans have neither the political incentive nor the inclination to shift to the left and to oppose the confirmation. So I wish I could give you better news, but the math and the probabilities just aren't there.
And once again, you're listening to Your Legal Rights. Our topic tonight: the president has nominated Brett Kavanaugh to be an associate justice of the United States Supreme Court. We've been talking a bit about the nuts and bolts of getting somebody nominated and confirmed, but also we want to talk a little bit about what a Supreme Court post-Anthony Kennedy looks like, what Justice Kavanaugh would add to that court if, in fact, he becomes Justice Kavanaugh, and really what the future might look like for the near term. Again, the phone number to us in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Where we left off before Jeff's call was, you talked about Judge Kavanaugh at the time working under Ken Starr and writing or being the primary author of the report that led to the impeachment of President Clinton. But then he was impressed with the demands of the presidency. When did that happen? When did he become exposed to all those demands and how that should affect any investigation taking place?
Well, Brett Kavanaugh, before he became a judge, actually served on the White House staff as part of the special counsel. And so, at least according to him, had an opportunity to observe very closely the demands that are placed on the presidency and literally turned 180 degrees. Some people who look at Kavanaugh from a different perspective see the Minnesota Law Review article arguing for expansion of presidential power as somewhat opportunistic. And we do know that a number of people who talk to the president about Supreme Court selections and about strategy going forward in the context of the Russia investigation have said that this article is something that they really should look at. And in fact, many of the arguments that we hear coming out of the White House about what should happen with the special prosecution are almost verbatim quotes from Judge Kavanaugh's article.
Now, we've talked a bit about impeachment, if there's going to be one, an investigation, whether there's going to be one. And with Jeff's help, we talked a bit about Roe versus Wade. But I'm going to ask you some other issues, because there's a whole myriad of issues that go through the Supreme Court. What do we know about Judge Kavanaugh on environmental and economic decisions?
What we know is that this is one of the clearly consistent lines for Judge Kavanaugh, is that on environmental and economic issues, issues that affect the interests of business, he virtually always sides with business. He has argued in both dissenting and concurring opinions for limitations on the Consumer Fraud Protection Act, on the Clean Air Act, he's argued for the unconstitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, for limits on the Environmental Protection Agency, limits on the power of unions. The list just goes on and on, and that's one of the clear strains in Judge Kavanaugh's thinking and in his writing and his scholarship. Of course, that's a strain that's already very strong on the Supreme Court, so he's simply going to add to that.
I was reading a position paper by the Alliance for Justice, and for those that are not familiar with it, it is a fairly liberal think tank out of Washington. They give us a lot of very good information. As on the more conservative side, we might hear from a group like the Federalists or the Pacific Legal Foundation. But they have a position paper on where Justice Kavanaugh stands on various issues. We'll be getting to that. We'll be talking to where he might be good, where he might be bad from the perspective of your average voter. These are issues that are going to affect all of us in one way or the other, whether it's environmental or the Affordable Care Act or pro-business versus any one of myriad issues. And we're going to go through this in more detail, but we do invite your calls. Again, you're listening to Your Legal Rights. I'm Jeff Hayden. The number here to talk to myself and my guest, Dean Johnson, here in the studio is 415-841-4134. And again, that's 415-841-4134. If you are calling from outside of our local calling area, please call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. My guest tonight is Dean Johnson. Dean has been an Emmy-nominated commentator, both legal commentator as well as political commentator. And we're talking about a nomination to the Supreme Court that, given Judge Kavanaugh's age, is likely to be a voice on the court for, conservatively speaking, 30 years. So it is going to affect us. He is one vote. We'll talk about just how much it affects us in a few moments. But again, we would encourage your calls. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. When we return after the break, I'm going to ask you about the median voter theorem, and that is to explain to me just why the vote of a Justice Kavanaugh might or might not make much of a difference, given that it appears that we have another conservative vote in an already conservative court. So it may not make the same difference that people think, but maybe it will. And you're listening to Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
So we've been talking a little bit about the nomination and confirmation, and we've moved on to talk a little bit about just Judge Kavanaugh, perhaps soon to be Justice Kavanaugh. And this brings us to the point of whether it would make much of a difference. Tell me what you were discussing earlier about the median voter theorem. Just what does that mean?
Well, you know, I teach this undergraduate class called Media, Politics, and Society, and the first thing I tell my undergraduates is that you can understand a great deal about what goes on in American politics by just understanding an insight that political scientists had a few decades ago called the median voter. And the median voter theorem says this: if you have a group of people, say – nine people, hypothetically, and four of them are arrayed on one side of a vote and four of them are arrayed on another side of a vote, and there's this one guy who's kind of in the middle, the median voter who can swing either way, that guy in the middle is always going to get his way. And the paradigm of the median voter is the man whose retirement started this entire controversy, Justice Anthony Kennedy. He was the median Supreme Court justice. We had a liberal wing of the court consisting of four justices. We had a conservative wing consisting of four justices, and then we had Justice Kennedy in the middle. And so Justice Kennedy was responsible for very conservative opinions like Citizens United, and for quite liberal opinions like Obergefell, the gay marriage decision.
Isn't to a certain extent, though, when you talk about a liberal decision or a conservative decision, you hear about things such as Citizens United. And wasn't Justice Kennedy primarily motivated by First Amendment on a lot of these things? He was an absolutist in free speech.
Well, he was, and that's not inconsistent with having a conservative opinion. Conservatives very much use free markets as a paradigm for their thinking, or at least they used to. And Justice Kennedy was one of those people. And the idea of the marketplace of ideas was something that really rang true and resonated with him. Citizens United was based on an earlier 1979 case called First National Bank of Boston called Bilotti, in which the court held that corporations have a protected First Amendment right to free speech. And that was sort of the wellspring. But obviously a very pro-business decision. With some very traditional, very powerful conservative ideas, the idea of the marketplace of ideas and how markets should be free as its basis. So, yeah, a conservative opinion full of conservative canons and conservative ideas that's pro-business, and that very much well sums up the conservative wing of the Supreme Court. On the flip side, you have an equally libertarian notion of expanding the rights of privacy, the rights of freedom of association to include something, an institution of same-sex marriage.
Joseph from Castro Valley, you're on your legal rights. Joseph, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Hey, Joseph.
Can you hear me?
Can hear you now. Welcome.
Yeah, so the question I have, and this is curiosity, and this is like overall frustration for anything that Democrats, how they interview a policymaker, let alone a Supreme Court justice, so they're always looking at one or two focus areas that resonate with Democrats. They don't resonate with their constituents. And that's the discussion that I'm hearing you also have, or a debate that you're also having. Like, if I'm a senator in South Dakota, or if there is a senator in South Dakota, they know their constituents are mixed. They're not all liberal. Why aren't they bringing up issues that resonate with their constituents? For example, family separation. Why is that not a concern?
Well,
all
of those are concerns, and there are some people have what they call litmus test issues. That there are some people who say, "Well, if this justice is going to vote against Roe versus Wade, I will never vote for him. If he's not going to vote to overturn Citizens United, I will never vote for him." But most senators, I think, and most presidents who've looked at potential nominees are concerned with a wide range of issues. And more than even being concerned with particular issues, I think the concern with every justice is how principled are they in terms of being a judge? Will they adhere to notions like stare decisis, which is holding to precedent? Will they be conservative in their approach and not take a case and go beyond what they're supposed to decide? The justices are supposed to decide only the case that's in front of them and make the narrowest possible decision. Are they sincere about doctrines like what we call constitutional avoidance, which is not making a ruling based on the Constitution if there's any other non-constitutional issue. All of those things are important, and believe me, all of those things will be discussed. I think Judge Kavanaugh will say many of the right things about that that people want to hear. For instance, there are a couple of Republican senators who have indicated that they may have trouble with Justice Kavanaugh or Judge Kavanaugh now, because they're concerned about his attitude towards Roe versus Wade. I'm sure the judge will say, no, you need not be concerned. I respect stare decisis, which is the Latin for the power of precedent. I will respect the precedents of the Supreme Court, one of which is Roe versus Wade. He'll say all the things that they want to hear. But he'll also be able to back it up, because when Judge Kavanaugh says, I respect judicial precedent and I understand judicial precedent, he has some credibility there, because he, along with some other judges, actually literally wrote the book on judicial precedent, the first treatise on judicial precedent that had been written to anybody's knowledge in the last 100 years. So he knows what he's talking about, and he's got some credibility there.
Joseph, thank you for joining us. You did ask about why Democrats tend to focus on one issue, and I want to put your mind at ease. We do intend to talk about other issues. That was the first one that came up from the first call. There are others we want to speak of tonight. I expect that you will hear about myriad issues from this program, from this nominee. But thank you very much for joining us. And Stefan from San Francisco, you're on Your Legal Rights. Welcome.
Hi. I have a question for the guest, and maybe this is similar to what you've been talking about just recently about the importance of precedents, but there's an article that was on CNN's website yesterday by Trevor Burrus, Why a Court with Kavanaugh Has Nothing to Fear. And he basically says that, you know, gay marriage is not going anywhere, will probably not be overturned, and so on, because of the importance of precedent. Even Scalia said apparently that, or Scalia had a theory that some precedents, even if they're wrong in his view, were so thoroughly a part of our law that justices shouldn't overturn them, and that maybe that having a court with a Justice Kavanaugh could help rein in this executive branch that has become too powerful. Do you see that as maybe a silver lining to the apparent unstoppability of this Kavanaugh becoming justice?
Yeah, great question, and I'm glad you asked that. I do agree with the Burrus article, and I've told people who've asked me, are you concerned about precedents like Roe versus Wade and Obergefell? And I said, yeah, I'm concerned. Anytime there's any hint that people's liberties are at risk, there's time for concern. But though I'm concerned, I'm not panicked. And there are a couple of reasons for that. First of all, as the political science Harold Lasky said, the secular tendency is for liberty to expand. It's extremely rare, extremely rare. In fact, I can think of no precedent where a court has actually taken away constitutional rights that the court has previously vested in groups of people. I mean, you wouldn't unsegregate the schools or reverse Griswold and take away a married couple's right to contraception. I mean, it's almost inconceivable, and the public outcry that would follow would be something that could be very destructive to the institution, and justices are aware of that. Remember, too, that the court, as I said at the beginning, is a passive institution. It can only react to cases that come before it. And in the context of Roe versus Wade and other civil rights cases, the kinds of cases that will come before it will be cases where people are challenging laws that restrict their freedoms. And they say, I've been injured by this law, and my injury sounds in a violation of constitutional rights. So there's that pressure to expand. It's very rare you're going to see a case where anybody's going to be arguing for taking away what are always vested rights. The other thing that gives me some confidence is we've talked about the median justice. The court with Kavanaugh would shift to the right, but the new median justice, the guy who would always get his way, is now John Roberts, the Chief Justice, which makes him probably one of the most powerful justices in American history. But John Roberts, even though he has personal questions about things like abortion and same-sex marriage, has said, and so far has adhered to the notion that those cases are what he referred to in his Senate confirmation hearings as super precedent. They've been not only decided by the court, but they've been affirmed and reaffirmed and reaffirmed so many times that I think the chances of a blanket overruling of any of those important cases, those super precedents, anytime soon is extremely small. That doesn't mean we don't have to be on guard. That doesn't mean we don't have to be out there fighting for our rights, because if you don't use them, you lose them. That doesn't mean that we don't have to get out to the polls and try to flip the Senate and try to flip the Congress so that we can get nominations and confirmations of the kinds of justices that we used to confirm, who were confirmed regardless of their ideological orientation, simply because they were good judges. I always point to the thing people can hardly believe, that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is the most liberal justice on the court, was actually confirmed by the Senate 97-3, even though she was very explicit about her very liberal leanings. That's because there was respect for the institution, respect for the nomination process, and respect for the right of a president to nominate whom he pleased, and there was room for compromise and bargaining with the filibuster rules and the cloture rules. We've moved away from that, but, frankly, I'd like to see us move back towards that.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. It looks like we have a couple other callers in the hopper, but while we're waiting for those, we've had a few callers that have called in and left us questions. So one calls in, talks about the Supreme Court of the United States. What are some useful resources online as we move ahead?
The resource I always go to is the SCOTUS blog. It's the official blog of the United States Supreme Court, and it's actually kind of cool. You can get not only the official opinions and last minute opinions and even the orders granting certiorari and things like that, but you can get scholarship, commentary on the cases, commentary on upcoming cases, and if you know what button to push, you can even hear the oral argument. So that's where I always go when I want the latest on the Supreme Court.
And for non-lawyers out there, certiorari is the Supreme Court saying, okay, we'll take up your case because we're interested in that, because we don't have to listen to what we don't want to. And with that, Oliver from San Francisco, you're on Your Legal Rights. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have been recently listening to a lot of old podcasts on Breitbart, just to try and find out more about them. From what I understand, a lot of Mr. Bannon's old podcasts, especially the ones he had Jeff Sessions as a senator on, they apparently want to, they really are interested in changing the Constitution by opening the Constitutional Convention. Their target convention is actually the amendment that they would like to affect is the 14th Amendment. Now, I would like to know, since the majority of the state legislatures are controlled by the Republicans, and they may not be too far away from having the majority, enough supermajority that they can throw open the Constitutional Convention, are there any sticking points where there would be some kind of argument pro or against that actually the Supreme Court would have to step in to clear things out, whether you can open up the Constitutional Convention or not? Does my question make sense?
It makes sense. I don't see the Supreme Court as having a role in that. In the unlikely event that anybody wants to call a constitutional convention, I think that's up to the states and up to the Senate. And I think the Supreme Court would say that's really a non-justiciable issue. That's something that we, the court, really don't deal with. It's up to other organs of government. I think it's interesting that you talk about Breitbart and the the sort of alt-right. I don't see Judge Kavanaugh as being part of that, but one thing I do think we're going to see in this Supreme Court is possibly the emergence of a notion of religious liberty, which is one of the code words that you often hear on the right, the notion that if you make a good faith claim of a religious belief that prevents you from following a law or a regulation or some sort of state mandate, that religious belief has to be accommodated. We just in the last session saw the Masterpiece Cake case where the baker didn't want to make a cake for a gay wedding, and the Supreme Court essentially punted on that because it takes us into the issue of, well, what is a good faith claim of religious belief? Traditionally, the court has not wanted to go there. Based on some of the things that Judge Kavanaugh has done on the D.C. Circuit, I think he might want to go there. Whether he can take anybody else with him remains to be seen.
Oliver?
All right, thank you.
Oliver, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Mateo from Oakland, you're on your legal rights. Mateo?
Mateo, are you there?
Are you looking for Michelle?
That might be. Michelle, you are welcome to join us. I don't know if we lost Mateo, but Michelle, you're up. Welcome. You're on your legal rights.
You're on, Michelle.
Okay. Your guest, and I apologize if I missed something and if any of this is redundant, but I have two questions. One, your guest has commented that it seems unlikely that a major, super precedent would be overturned even by this, what would be a very conservative court. And I just want to ask, aren't there other ways of overturning precedents besides doing it directly, like making decisions around the edges of something that that can undermine people's rights in ways that are less visible? That's question number one. And question number two is this guy's involvement in the investigation of Clinton many years ago. He was an incredibly aggressive assistant to the special prosecutor and had a lot to do with the attack by the special prosecutor on Clinton, whether or not that was you believe that that was a good idea or a bad idea. And now it appears he's completely reversed himself. Doesn't that reflect on the integrity of this man's the question of whether he really has principles or if he's just totally kind of ideologically committed to one side of the political spectrum? End of questions.
Yeah. Michelle, thank you. Let me ask you about the first part of Michelle's question. Mm-hmm. Michelle asked if there's an easier way to get around precedent rather than out and out overruling it. And I'm asking that with the vision of a spokesman I heard last night who said that Roe versus Wade, and I'm only choosing that as an example, would unlikely to be directly overturned, but rather may die the death of a thousand cuts. Is that more where we're going on some of these controlling rulings on environmental legislation or business or voter rights or anything in addition to Roe versus Wade?
Yeah, that's exactly where we're going, and especially in the area of reproductive rights, Roe versus Wade. People have referred to it repeatedly as the chipping away process. You don't just knock down the statue, but you chip, chip, chip at it. And Judge Kavanaugh has been a participant, a knowing participant in that. One of his best-known decisions on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, interesting in the context of the news we're hearing now, is that he ruled that an organ of the federal government called the Office of Refugee Resettlement could limit the rights of a minor immigrant who was in its custody to an abortion. So that was a little cut, one of those thousand cuts at the precedent of Roe versus Wade. He was writing a dissenting opinion, but he was then backed up by the Supreme Court when the case finally got up there. So yeah, we see this chipping all the time.
Dissent, didn't he accuse the majority of the D.C. Circuit of creating a new right for immigrants in custody in order to obtain immediate abortion on demand? Isn't, weren't those his words?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's, you know, you wonder how that fits with the 14th Amendment's notion that equal protection of the law is available to anyone who comes within the jurisdiction of the United States, regardless of how they got here.
And as to the second part of Michelle's question?
As to the second part, to me, just looking at this from the outside, it looks extremely opportunistic for someone who was one of the masterminds of the Clinton special prosecution, who actually wrote the final report for the special prosecutor that actually led to an impeachment, to then turn literally 180 degrees and write a scholarly article saying, oh, you know what? The president is really too busy. He has too many responsibilities to be distracted by investigations and prosecutions. You can't investigate and you can't prosecute. You certainly can't prosecute a sitting president. Now, I'm sure if Brett Kavanaugh were here now, he would say, no. It was simply an honest change of mind. I had not realized the depth of the responsibility of a president and all the demands on the president. I now realize that all of those silly investigations and prosecutions are just a distraction, and if they were allowed to go too far, they would cripple the federal government. Well, they certainly didn't cripple the federal government when Bill Clinton was in office and when the Ken Starr prosecution was going on, aided and abetted by Brett Kavanaugh. So I kind of question it, the argument. I question his evidence, and I question the reasoning behind the article.
Michelle, thank you for joining us. And Mateo from Oakland, if you are still out there and hear us, feel free to call us right back. We still have time for one or two more calls. If you have questions for Dean Johnson, my guest, our phone number here in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Mateo, are you back on the line with us?
Hello.
Hi, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hey, Mateo.
Hi there. Yes, so I'm among the people who've already accepted that Mr. Kavanaugh is going to become Associate Justice.
Yeah,
and so I'm thinking about the next 30 years of my life. And you guys are talking about how the court trends towards expanding individual liberties, and then there's all these talks about, you know, the court being going to trend towards expanding like religious beliefs exemptions possibly in the future. I don't know. And I'm thinking, well, I myself have like really intense beliefs about things, but they're not religious in nature. For example, I really believe in environmental protection, that sort of things, and I put that into my business. So what kind of thing or situation or statute, I don't know, in which the court may one day like recognize belief exemptions or even beliefs that are not religious in nature?
Well, I don't know if they will. I think it's a very difficult road to go down from a standpoint of logic and legal scholarship. I'll just give you a few examples of what the court has done in the past. There was a case that came up where Native Americans who used peyote, which is a controlled substance, it's mescaline, in their religious ceremonies argued before the Supreme Court that this they needed a religious exemption from the drug laws because, after all, this was their religious belief. The court said, no. Look, you may be very sincere in your beliefs, but as long as you stay in the United States, you respect the law. So they drew sharp lines. The Masterpiece Cake case, which just came down, seems to blur that line a little bit. And Judge Kavanaugh, as a justice, I think would blur that line even more. He has voted, for example, to exempt priests who run a hospital from providing contraception and or abortion. On the other hand, he has said that it's just fine for a town council to require a prayer and for everyone to sit in a respectful and prayerful position, even though they be atheists. So there seem to be some double standards, and he seems to be giving weight to what he perceives as good faith religious beliefs. Traditionally, the court has used the term entanglement when it comes to freedom of religion and free exercise cases and says, look, we're not in a position to judge whether somebody has a good faith religious belief. And if we go down that road, people can claim all sorts of exemptions from all sorts of law, and down that road lies chaos. So how far we would go down that road, if at all, I don't know, but I see those tendencies in Justice Kavanaugh.
And just to clarify for listeners that are not attorneys, what we commonly refer to as the right to religion, right to religious freedom, really breaks down into two things. The government should not restrict the free exercise of religion, nor should there be a state religion. But there's nothing in there that says that there can't be any entanglement with religion whatsoever.
That's true, but the court has tried to avoid those entanglements. For example, churches are traditionally exempt from taxes, and it's been argued that we should look at the businesses of churches and their involvements and whether the church is a legitimate church or not. And the court says, no, you know, we really do not want to go there. We do not want to get in. We don't want to open that floodgate and get into what's legitimate church business and what isn't, and what's a legitimate church and what's not.
Mateo, thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights.
Thank you, guys.
As we're nearing the end of the hour, I would like to ask you a few questions for quick answers. I think there's a lot of stuff that people are listening to, people have been asking about, that we can answer pretty quickly.
Sure.
The first is, a caller has called in and said that with the prospect of a conservative majority of the Supreme Court for the next 40 years, it's a pretty daunting prospect. And the listener wants to know whether term limits might pose an option on judges and justices as a way to address this, similar to what we do in state court.
It might, but that would require a constitutional amendment. And frankly, the role of the court really is contrary to the notion of participating in sort of in electoral politics or in term limitations. We want the justices to be as independent as possible, because they, if they perform their role correctly, they are the people who speak up for those who don't have the votes. They're the ones who protect the rights of minorities and small groups and insular groups that really don't have a proper or sufficiently powerful role in the political bargaining process. So we want to preserve that independence, and I, for one, like to see that separation between justices and the electoral process. Quite frankly, I'm uncomfortable with California's notion of electing judges and justices. I think it causes justices and candidates for judicial office sometimes to pander to the electorate, which they shouldn't be doing.
Can this confirmation be stalled until the election in the hope of flipping the Senate?
I don't see any way that can happen. I see at least three senators on the Democratic side who have very, very strong incentives, if they want to be reelected, to defect to the Republican side and vote for confirmation. And I suspect that's what's going to happen. I suspect we will see a confirmation before the election with between 52 and 54 votes.
Knowing we have just a matter of seconds left, but the obvious question, is the Senate likely to flip?
Right now, it has about a 33% chance of flipping. If the Democrats who are currently facing toss-up elections don't support Judge Kavanaugh and stay within the Democratic count, the Democratic camp, the chances of a Senate flip go down significantly.
Dean, we have about a minute for you to sum up. If there's any last-minute thoughts, anything you would like to say before we go off the air.
I think that we can expect and anticipate that there will be a Justice Kavanaugh, that the court is going to shift to the right. But I think we need to remember that there are institutional constraints like stare decisis, the respect for precedent, the limitations on justiciability of controversy, all of those things that lawyers really care about that limit the power of the court. I would be concerned, but it's not time to panic. The institution will survive.
And with that, my thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco and KALW.org. I'm Jeff Hayden. Our topic tonight has been the presidential nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to be an Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court. We've been talking about how someone gets nominated, the process by which he or she gets confirmed. If Judge Kavanaugh does become Justice Kavanaugh, what does this mean to us? And just what does the Supreme Court do? My guest tonight has been Emmy-nominated legal and political analyst, as well as Redwood City attorney Dean Johnson. Dean, thank you again for joining us once again.
My pleasure.
We will return next week with your legal rights. And 2 weeks from tonight, we will once again have Call a Lawyer program operating here at KALW. Again, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 in San Francisco. Our thanks to you for listening and to our production assistant, Martin McLean. And at the controls, as always, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Thank you again for listening.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.